MNK Talk YA now presents The Midnight Star, Part 1, a young elites novel by Marie Lu. Welcome back to MNK Talk YA.
I'm Marissa Snyder.
And I'm Katie Bradford.
And this is our young adult fiction podcast.
And we're almost done with our second series.
Oh my gosh, I know. There are no short stories with this book either, this series either, so.
Should we write some? I'm just kidding.
Should we write to Marie Lu to have her write some?
Marie Lu, if you listen to this, as I'm sure you must, please write some short stories in the next 2 weeks for us.
If you could have short stories about the young elites, what short story would you want?
Well, it depends a little bit on what ends, you know, how things end, because sometimes the short stories are cool when they, like, show what happens afterwards, right? But that's, I think, true. Some of the characters I want to, like, I would love to get more about Maggiano before he met up with them.
Yes, agreed. That's, like, my number one.
I would love to see, why can't I think of his elite name now? Sergio, what's his name? The Storm?
Oh, Sergio.
The Rainmaker.
Rainmaker. Yeah.
The Rainmaker's, experience with the elites. I think that would be kind of a cool short story.
Ooh, I didn't even think of that one. That's a really good one.
And what else would I like to see? And I really am interested in Violetta's perspective for some stuff. So I don't know if, or maybe seeing their parents, Adelina and Violetta's parents, like, early on or something would have been kind of cool. I don't know.
To see them as children. We do get a lot of flashbacks of Violetta and Adelina as children, though.
Yeah, but we don't see any from her perspective. She's still a little bit of a mystery to me because I don't know what she's thinking, even though I see the way she's acting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I also really want to see a short story written about Enzo when he's banished. And, like, I want to see him and Daphne, like, that whole
That would chapter. Be interesting.
I really want a short story with that, so.
Or what about Maeve and Lucent she was banished?
We've got
some good ideas.
So many good short stories that could be written. Oh my gosh.
Also, you know what we have to do next week?
What?
We have to either find or come up with our own fan name. You know how we were like the Lunartics we found out about? And we said for each series, we had to find one.
I was actually thinking about that during my, 16-hour car ride. And so I was trying to think of what we would do for our fan names. And what kept stumping me was that the book is The Young Elites. And I was like, well, the problem with this is I'm not exactly all that young. And I'm not really all that elite.
Or maybe we should come up with our own young elite names. You know, like the puppet maker or the, I don't know.
Oh my gosh, I really like that idea.
Okay.
It's better than the, what did I come up? Oh, I came up with the middle-aged mediocres. Because that's kind of what I felt like.
Would you proudly wear a shirt like that?
I'm a middle-aged mediocre. I like how everything is a t-shirt too. No, okay. I really like coming up with her own elite names.
Okay, let's try and do that for next week. Except maybe remind me because I might forget to do that.
Okay, I think it should tie in too, because I had a personal question for you this week.
Ooh.
I know, because we learned about all the alignments that they have and, like, all the gods. And there's that whole thing where, like, they're going on this journey now to heal this rift.
Yep.
In the underworld, and they need all of the 12 alignments. Like, every young elite needs to be representing an alignment in order to heal the rift. And so I was wondering, like, what gods do you think we align with?
That's a really good question. And now I'm trying to think of all 12, because I keep only remembering, like, fear. And then I was thinking about war and death. And I don't think either one of us align with those three.
Well, I wrote them down.
Okay. Remind me of all of them again.
Okay. So the 12 gods represent fear, fury, ambition, passion, wisdom, joy, empathy, beauty, time, death, war, and greed.
I mean, I want to say I'm like passion and wisdom and obviously beauty, but I'm just kidding about that.
For you, one. I was going to pick passion, wisdom, joy. And then I was also going to pick time for you, because I feel like you're really good about like not wasting time. Like you're always planning a trip. You're like always scheduling time to see your friends. So I thought that. And also maybe fear, because I know you have really bad FOMO.
I do have really bad FOMO.
I think we definitely both align with passion, because, I mean...
this is like our passion project.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is there one for young adult reading, or...
Because that would be us. Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was really funny. And then I think I would be fear, definitely. Passion. I don't know. Maybe...
I think your empathy. Was that one of them or something?
Empathy.
Or something,
yeah, like that? I think I would pick empathy.
I think you're really good at...
And maybe death. I don't know. I'm so dark sometimes.
Well, oh yeah. I was thinking about death from a different perspective, but you're right. You're kind of attracted to all those like horror stories and like whatnot. Ooh, I think you're going to like some of the research I did this week. Although you'll probably ask me questions I won't be able to answer, but that's okay.
What did you research? Tell me everything.
Okay. Well, first... Well, actually, the other thing I'll just save for next week because it'll still be related. But the big thing I looked into was dungeons, because we saw both where she was keeping Taryn and then where she was kind of imprisoned at when they attacked, what's it called? The Sealand? No. They were attacking the Sunlands, right?
Yes.
So we saw two different prisons, and I remember she was talking about, like, the difference, because in her prison, they were, like, way up top. Like, it went up into the sky in a big tower. So mm-hmm. I was kind of like, I wonder how different dungeons look. So I, like, researched dungeons and Ooh. Different torture from the
Oh, dear.
Middle Ages. Because it went on this whole...
Keep
and then
coming
I,
back to it.
I ended up reading about Dracula and, like, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, but, my goodness. Because Taryn's prison was pretty terrifying. Wasn't it, like, in a moat, and then there was, like, an island in the middle of the water?
Yeah, I was actually thinking that could be an interesting short story, too, to be one of the, like, guards for Taryn or something. Man. Or one of the people who Adelina, like, sneaks up on. But, like, hearing their perspective of, like, just, like, not, you know, not having any powers and being surrounded by these elites or affected by these elites somehow and, like, you know, being intimidated by them. But, okay. So, originally, there weren't really dungeons in medieval castles. And what would happen a lot of times was barons would kidnap the children of other barons and hold the kids hostage to, like, for different political reasons and whatnot.
Okay.
But the children would usually be able to, like, roam through the castle fine and just not, like, leave the premises. So they didn't really, like, stay in a dungeon necessarily yeah. back then. And then they had this thing called the Great Keep, which was the main tower of the castle, but it originally was supposed to be, like, the most secure place, so it was more for if they were being invaded, kind of the stronghold of the castle.
Oh, okay.
But eventually they started, you know, kind of creating these nicer areas and bedrooms and, like, having all this luxurious space, and the idea of political prisoners became more common, and they started to have kind of more dungeon-y type stuff. Hmm. And I was reading about this one thing. It's called the Oubliette. Oubliette. Oh. And it's supposedly worse than a dungeon, and it's that's like translation is called the Forgotten Room.
Oh God.
And this is what made me like really read into this, because I read a quote that said, if you remember the Chokey from Ronald Dahl's Matilda, it's very similar.
No.
So it was a tiny vertical shaft that you could stand up in, but you couldn't crouch, kneel, or sit, or even necessarily turn around. And they would lower you down into it from, like, a trap door and then close the trap door after you were down there.
And it is the Chokey.
Yeah. And so you'd have to stand there in the dark until you were released, if you ever were. And in some cases, they'd lower down food and water if it was important for you to survive. But in a lot of cases, they wouldn't. And sometimes people would actually, like, eat the remains of the person who had been there before or things like that.
No. Oh my God, that's awful.
So then I was reading about some of the most famous dungeons of all time. And the guy who inspired Dracula. Wait, let me find this.
Oh, Vlad the Impaler?
Yeah, Vlad the Impaler. So he was one of these kind of, him and his brother were kidnapped by the, starts with an O, why can't I think of them? The Ottomans.
Ottomans, okay.
Yep. And that's where they think he learned about impalement and stuff. And his brother, because they still, like, taught them philosophy and all this other stuff while they were hostages there. But he really grew up, like, despising his captors, whereas his brother actually became really good friends with the captors.
Ooh, like the Stockholm son of the,
yeah. So that was kind of interesting. So then I was like, okay, so Vlad is known as the Impaler. Like, what does that really mean? So then I started reading about impalement.
Oh, my God. We're turning into Adelina. Do you realize this?
Well, I think I was trying to impress you. I think that was my goal this week, to, like, go far enough down a rabbit hole that I would learn something. So one of the – and they're not even sure if Vlad – really did all the stuff he's written to have done. A lot of the stuff was written while he was alive, but they think it was like an intimidation thing also, so he like kind of spread these rumors himself a little bit. But supposedly he impaled 2,000 prisoners of war and put them all along the road to his castle at one point.
Oh my God.
And he's the guy who inspired Dracula.
Right.
But so what they would do was the victim was laid down on his belly and split up at the rectum. And then a paste was applied to stop the bleeding before a stake was hammered into the body, and it was planted straight in the ground. And if you moved at all, it would drive the stake deeper into your body. And depending on where it went through, it may only be a few minutes before you died. But if it went along the spine, you could last for several days like that.
Oh my God.
So then on this page I was reading about that, I was reading about other execution.
No!
Should I keep going or should I stop?
About dungeons.
Well, it started with dungeons, but so Dracula, his dungeon was like the big thing. Okay, I can go back to dungeons. So, okay. Someday remind me to tell you about scaphism, which is a torture method used in Persia that's pretty disturbing.
But I'm gonna not remind you.
But so there were a couple of different like some of the I think it was the article was called like the coolest dungeons ever or something. But one of these dungeons, let me find the name of it. Oh, no, it's called The Most Horrifying Dungeons. Okay, that's better. I think maybe I Googled the coolest dungeons. So it was built by William the Conqueror in 1068. And it had like a really long and bloody history. And they reopened it in 2009 and showed some of the like, tortures they used to do back in the day. And the first month it was open, 15 people fainted and 4 experienced fear-inspired vomiting.
Oh my gosh. When did it open? When was this?
In 2009. That was like when they started having tours of it.
Could you imagine if you had gone there, you would have been throwing up all over the place?
I would not have gone there because I know better. And then I also read about this dungeon from 2012 because dungeons aren't just a thing from the Middle Ages. There was this Boston man named Jeffrey Portway who was arrested for plotting to kidnap, torture, and eat children.
No.
And he had built, like, a chamber of horrors basically underneath his house that sounds really disturbing.
That's like H.H. Holmes from The Devil in the White City, kind of.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking of, actually. I forgot until you said it now. But when I was reading about it, that's what I was thinking about. Because whenever I read about serial killers now, that's who I imagine, because that book was so good at, like, getting you into his mind.
But how terrifying to have, like, a vault in your house, essentially, that you painstakingly build to keep people prisoners. Ugh. It's so messed up.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Or even, like, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or whatever, you know, where she finds that room. Or they find that room in that... Have you read that one?
Yeah, I did.
I don't know. Just, like, all the places where the people,
end.
Like,
yeah.
Like put so much work into, like, being effective killers.
That's the
creepy.
Scariest part is, like, the amount of foresight and, like, planning that goes into it. That's what freaks me out. It's not, like, some just whim that they decide to do this. It's, like, careful, painstakingly planned out. Ooh, I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah. Well, So going back to Vlad the Vampire / Dracula. So there was one rumor that he drank blood, right? That's what kind of started the whole Dracula vampire thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually some historical documents that say that he would dine among the impaled victims that he had impaled.
What?
And just,
like, they would be sitting there impaled and he would be talking to
them? And he would wash his hands in their blood and dip his bread in their blood.
No. Oh my God.
Although I feel like washing your hands in the blood, while also creepy, is not as we like drinking someone's blood, I think, is still a step beyond that.
I don't know. I feel like any type of playing with someone's blood is like too much.
Yeah. Well, at least he wasn't pouring it into a lemonade thing and serving it at grandma's, like the wicked wolf of whatever.
Or putting it on his face, like doing a facial, a vampire facial.
Yeah. So anyways, that's the rabbit hole I went down. That's pretty much the only real research I did. I mean, I can tell you more about different torture, but that's what I did.
Well, I didn't. My research wasn't all that much more in like, you know, lighthearted. I researched actually safety coffins because we were talking about being buried alive last week.
Yeah,
and I learned that in the 18th century there were patents for safety coffins that were designed to prevent premature burial, and I guess there was like a fear of being alive, of being buried alive, that spiked during like the 18th and 19th centuries.
Was there any reason for that? Like, was there either a popular book that came out, or like something that happened, or like?
So Edgar Allan Poe actually wrote a bunch of short stories that dealt with being buried alive. The most famous is The Fall of the House of Usher. And so that kind of created like a frenzy of a fear of being buried alive. And all of these safety coffins were designed back then. And the basic gist of it was most of them just had some kind of signaling device that would allow people to communicate with the outside world and let them know that they'd been buried alive. So some had like really complex air tubes that were inserted to deliver oxygen, but most of them involved tying a bell to the body. And so if you found you were buried alive, you could ring the bell and let someone know that you were down there. And some people say that the expression saved by the bell came from this idea of a safety coffin. I don't think it actually was. I think that's actually from boxing.
Oh.
I think that's where that expression comes from. But it was just thrown out there as like a possible origin of that expression.
I think it's kind of crazy the way the mind works. Like the fact that, you know, I mean, I'm sure after Jaws came out, people were more afraid of sharks than they ever had been. Or
sure.
Like, after, you know, like the way we can be so influenced by like one story or, you know, whatever you've heard most recently or whatever. Like the idea of being buried alive, probably no one even really thought about it until they read this book. And then everyone was thinking about it and talking about it unless they heard, you know, but
because everyone, it's like, you know, when someone hears about something really popular, like S-Town, for example, everyone's talking about S-Town. And it was probably the same thing with, like, Edgar Allan Poe's books back then, or, you know, whatever else was popular.
Yeah. It's just kind of crazy.
I know, I know. And then I also did some more research about rebirth, kind of, because I know that was a big theme. And we were talking a little bit last time about Greek gods and just, you know, myths in general, especially since there's a lot more about like the gods in the young elites and their kind of influence. And so I learned that the god who kind of symbolized rebirth back in Greek mythology was Dionysus, who was the god, also the god of wine. And I thought this was actually pretty cool because, so in one version I read, Dionysus is the child of Zeus and Persephone, which is interesting because Persephone also like bridges the gap between the underworld. And so Zeus's wife Hera was so jealous that she sent the Titans to kill Dionysus when he was a baby, and they consumed the baby except his heart, which someone was able to save the baby's heart, and they sewed it into Zeus's thigh, where it gestated, and then Dionysus was born again. So he's associated with rebirth. And it's also kind of interesting because he's also the god of wine. And the idea of death and rebirth is also really associated with vineyards, because at the end of the grape season, the vines are cut back until they're practically dead. And then in spring, they like burst back into life for the next growing season. So wine is associated with rebirth. And they said that could be one of the reasons why wine is also associated with Jesus and resurrection. And we drink wine, you know, as a symbol of, you know, Jesus's blood, which represents resurrection. I don't know. It was kind of cool.
That is kind of cool. And this reminded me, so we just celebrated my sister's 21st birthday.
Speaking of wine.
And I actually didn't have any wine, but a lot of the cards were about wine. And there was one where, like, a police officer pulled over a, like, priest or something. And he goes, "What have you been drinking?" And on the front it says water. And he said, and on the inside it's like, "It smells like wine," or something like that. And the guy goes, "Jesus has done it again." And it was just kind of funny. That's what I just thought of. But that is really cool. I never... It's also cool to me, like, the ways that old mythology relates to more modern religions.
Oh, yeah. It's like, there's so many parallels.
Like, when I hear some old myths, just because I didn't grow up with them, they kind of sound like, you know, I'm like, people really bought that? Or, like, that's crazy, you know, whatever. And then you see the connection, or you try to explain something about, like, Christianity to someone who, like, doesn't know anything about it, and you're like, wait, this kind of sounds a little crazy, too. Just a little. No, a lot. But
I also like that, like, we're learning more about the gods in the young elites. Like, we get the whole myth of Laertes, the god of joy, and how when he fell to earth, that, like, created ripple effects that resulted in the blood fever that started, that created the young elites. Like, I really liked that backstory, and, like, we have a reason now for why the blood fever happened. So, is the underworld seeping into the living world because of Tristan and Enzo being resurrected, and the gods are angry because they had an elite, two elites stolen from them?
I think that that, like, accelerated it, but I think it was kind of happening just from, like, I think everything was, like, messed up due to the blood fever.
I mean, like, they were never really meant to be.
Yeah.
In the first place.
Yeah.
Okay.
But back to that point, I don't know if it just would have been kind of like what was happening before, where they had, like, these short lives and their powers couldn't really withstand. I don't know if pulling Enzo and Tristan from the underworld, I don't know if that's what messed it up for, like, the world as a whole. Because now it's, like, not just them, but the whole world.
Yeah. It's like something is poisoning the mortal world because there's, like, an imbalance.
I'm also, like, kind of confused about, like, how long the blood fever lasted.
That's, like, a good question.
Are they, like, are these young elites, like, these, I don't know, age 15 to 25 or whatever? Like, is that the only marked people?
I think so. Yeah, I think also it was, like, seems, a very brief period.
Because that also seems just weird to think about. Because it almost sounds like when she switched all these laws to, like, favor the marked instead of the, you know, when she's,
oh,
like,
oh yeah,
like, it seems like it would be a relatively small group,
small
and
body,
a pretty young group still. And then I was like, well, maybe there's more, or I don't know. I just, like, was feeling it, just I was confused about how long the blood fever was around.
My feeling was that it was a brief period of time, but it just took out a lot of the population.
But then that would still mean there's not that many marked people, right? Well, I guess if it took out a lot, then most of the people who survived would be. But still, like, you would think no one over the age of, like, 40 or something, and no one under the age of, well, we also don't know how long people lived back then.
I did find their ages, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I forget where I found that, but I looked that up. At the beginning of the series, Violetta's 14, Adelina's 16, Enzo's 20, Taryn's 22, Raffaele is 19, and I think Lucent is 18. Oh, and Gemma is 16.
Okay, so that kind of fits in with the 15 to 25 range that I was imagining in my head. And even though everyone who had the blood fever over the age of 25 would have died, there were still a lot of people who didn't, right? I just felt like, I don't know, I was just, like, having trouble.
Yeah, doing a timeline. It's also kind of weird how, like, I really like that they're joining on this quest together to, like, heal the rift between the underworld and the mortal world. But also, it was just kind of odd to me that, like, Raffaele just knew this, knew what had to be done. You know, like,
and that he suddenly was able to put it all together. Like, he just found out that they were losing their, you know, that their powers
were
hurting.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden he was like, okay, we need all 12 alignments represented. We need to go to this place where Laertes fell, like... I don't know. I was just kind of like, how does he know for sure that that's what needs to be done?
I also found it kind of funny that with 12 alignments, and if they each have, like, 5, that they didn't have anyone who had war or death with that whole group of people.
I know, yeah, that's true. But I love the idea that they need Taryn to, like, you know, it's
great.
Oh,
I do too. And I cannot wait to see how that works out. How they get him on board.
I don't know. And it's also just like, it's like a race against time now because Violetta's really sick. Leo's already dead. Lucent's bones are like on their last legs. Everyone is just deteriorating. Like, it was so sad to see Enzo, especially how his arms were just like covered in burn marks. Although I guess we really don't have to worry about him anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, that scene was crazy.
That scene was crazy.
I felt really bad, though, because it was sad when, like, Tristan went crazy and attacked Maeve, and when she sent that letter to Raffaele, he knew immediately what was going to happen, and it was just, like, I don't know, it was hard to watch them have to kill someone that they both really loved.
It was, but I also think it was good for Adelina to trust the daggers again.
I agree.
The fact that, you know, they kind of, like, I mean, they both were sad about losing Enzo. Like, they kind of had that, what did she say, like, grief brought us together again or something like that. Or maybe, I forget who said that, but someone said something about that in the last chapter.
Yeah, because she could have let Enzo kill Raffaele, but she stepped in and saved him. And he kind of, like, looks at her at the end, like, you didn't have to do that. But then he saves her, too, because she was going to, like, jump off that cliff or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, and he saved her and he killed Enzo.
That was huge. I didn't, yeah. Ugh.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because this still is not really a, I don't even think that the whole group necessarily wants this to work or buys into the fact that it's necessary. Kind of to your point, like, I don't think they all necessarily trust that this is a real problem that needs to be fixed in this one way.
I mean, the proof is kind of...
I mean, I think that they have no reason to, they don't have another theory necessarily, but I do think that, like, they're trusting Raffaele, and I think that is a really weak level of trust for a lot of them.
But I think it was also, I think it was also good for Adelina to see Enzo die to realize that she was living in a fantasy world that didn't exist, where she thought, you know, that he was going to be the same and that bringing him back was going to solve all of her problems. I don't know. I kind of liked that, you know, Raffaele was right in the end. Like, you shouldn't bring ex-boyfriends back from the dead. And so I think that, like, her seeing that he was right and that she was so far off with regards to how Enzo could be, I think that was a turning point for her to say, you know, I think I should trust Raffaele.
Well, and that she had the realization that she really wasn't ready to die as much as she thinks she's, like, yeah. What do you think? Like, I'm really curious to see what happened when Maggiano was figuring out his alignment. That last one that made him storm
off. I know,
off.
And we ended right before we found his flashback, because we ended right before the Maggiano chapter.
I know, that's when I was like, let's try and talk today instead of tomorrow, because I want to keep reading.
I don't blame you. Well, I'm sure it has something to do with when he was with the priests. We know that he lived with some mean priests. I like that we're getting flashbacks. You know, we have had a couple flashbacks that give a little bit more depth to the world. Because the books are short, you know? They are
short.
Really sadly short. So I think having the flashbacks definitely provide some needed background.
Yeah, I think the flashbacks and the little excerpts still. I know we've talked about them a lot, but I do feel like it adds so much more to the world and a little more context to some of the stories.
And actually... A lot of the excerpts are really starting to inform each chapter. I actually just read one. Mm-hmm. I wrote one down because I thought it was so beautiful. It was like an excerpt from a monologue of Campasia and a name I can't pronounce. Arathisimus, whatever. But it was one of the chapters when Adelina was really struggling with her hallucinations and she was like torturing the people who weren't marked, which is like an exact opposite of what happened during the blood fever when marked people were targeted. Now she's, like, targeting unmarked people.
Yeah, she keeps talking about equality, and it's like, this isn't equal. This, you just flipped who's the victim and who's the, like...
The perpetrator, yeah, exactly.
Bully, yeah.
Anyway, and sorry, continue. And the excerpt just said, where will you go when the clock strikes 12? What will you do when you face yourself? How will you live knowing what you've done? How will you die if your soul's already gone? And I was like, the excerpts, they're just so poetic and, like, they really make the book really beautiful.
And it's cool that they're, like, excerpts from this, you know, like, they're all made up,
Yeah, Marie Lou created all of these all of these stories and plays. This one's from a play.
It's not just like she found quotes somewhere that are relevant.
She made them all up. And like there were excerpts from letters I liked too. Like there was one about like an excerpt from The Blood Fever of like people sharing letters like about the sickness that was spreading. I don't know. It was really, really well done. I thought like that was a really smart step on her part.
Well, and she also started the whole book with a longer excerpt from, I think it was like, a witness's account of Queen Adelina's siege on the nation of Dumor.
Oh, yeah.
So it was just some guy saying, I saw her once and kind of talk, but it gives you another kind of just view of what's happened since the last book ended, you know? And this whole idea that it's a huge, like it's happening, it's not just these six people who are affected, it's like the worlds are affected by her.
And her reign. I mean, she's becoming such a vicious queen. And I mean, I like how Maggiano keeps trying to advise her and saying, like, you need to focus on controlling the lands you already have. You need to show your subjects that you can be generous. But it's so hard for her to choose good.
What do you think her voices are?
These whispers? Like,
do you think it's...
No. They're just, like, they're getting really strong now. And they're, like...
And they don't trust anyone or anything. And they, you know, I mean, you know, like, even when Maggiano, like, gives her good advice like that. And her immediate, the voices basically tell her he's going to turn on you or why, you know, like he doesn't, like they're always just planting doubt and fear and hatred.
They always point out the worst case scenario for everything.
So is that like her subconscious? Is that like something related with like the gods and alignment she has, like fury and fear and whatnot?
I don't know.
Or is that just like,
I don't know. I think it's just a symptom of her gift, which is now a curse that is making her lose her mind.
So it's just her going crazy.
At one point, I forget where she is, but someone says something about nightmares, and she was like, I am the nightmare. It's like, it's so true. She's just... I don't know if there's any redeeming her now. Even though we do see her with Maggiano, and we see a few... beautiful moments with her and Maggiano trying to bring out the good in her. I really liked the scene when they're in the baths together. She kept saying, like, there was part of her that was saying, like, talk to him. Like, open up to him.
Or even her concern for him when they were both trapped, when they were both captured.
Yeah, exactly. And so you just see these, like, very brief moments where you know, you think, oh, wouldn't it be great if she could just be like this all the time? I do like in the baths, so those caves, it reminded me of the Blue Grotto in Capri. Like the, have you ever been there?
I don't think so.
No. It's just this cave where you go into it and it's completely lit up underneath the water in blue. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, and there's like a lot of caves like that around the world that have either like phosphorescent algae or some kind of bioluminescence that make the cave glow in really beautiful colors. Like, I think the other one is the Waitomo Caves in New Zealand. They're caused by phosphorescent glowworms. And so I really liked that, I don't know, she, like, created this really beautiful moment where they have this private space that they go to. And it's so beautiful, even in the midst of, like, all this ugliness that's going on, they still manage to kind of have some moments together.
And it felt like the only time she could kind of be like that was when she was physically removed from everything else, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you even saw when she just overheard, you know, you see the fear she's instilled in everyone and the fact that she doesn't have any loyal people, really. It's mostly just people who are afraid to cross her.
Yes. Yeah.
And she still has such an interesting relationship with her sister because still most of her nightmares involve her sister being dead.
Exactly. And you know what?
And that's a nightmare. It's not like a, oh, good. You know, it's not like that's what she wants. It's like that's part of the horror that she like experiences every night.
Exactly. You can tell, like, and you know she does still care for her sister a lot because other people see that too. Like, when Raffaele writes her and he says, your sister is dying, you have to come at once. I mean, I think part of him wanted to reach out to her to let her know out of, you know, the goodness of his heart that her sister was dying. But I think part of him, and also I think Adelina thinks this too, is that he knows he can use her sister against her. And he knew that if he said that something bad was happening to Violetta, that's the only way she would come.
Yeah. Well, and I also thought it was interesting that they, you know, at first they were like, well, it could just be he heard that she left you and is using that to try and get you over here. And it could have totally been that way, except that she actually did go there because she also still always, she's still trying to help Adelina and thought that the daggers could somehow help her do that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you know what else? So I was thinking that, like, in every book that we read, I was wondering, like, what scene would you most like to see made into a movie? Or, like, if it was made into a movie, like, what scene would you most be excited to see?
I mean, this series has so many cool, like, battles and stuff, and with the invisibility and all that. Like, I feel like that stuff is the cool part to watch.
I know. I was trying to think of, like, in the first book, in the second book, in the third book, like, what scene from each book would I most want to see. I think from the first book, I would really want to see the horse race.
I think it might be the whole Enzo versus Taren.
Ooh, scene. The duel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Rose Society, I think I would most like to see the Balira chase when they're riding the Baliras.
Yeah. I'm just so fascinated by those creatures in general. But I also think when she's tricking the Night King.
Oh, yeah.
With Maggiano, I think that could be a cool scene. Or even when her and Maggiano, when she first shows him her trick and he can mimic it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they build those worlds. Like, I think that could be a cool scene, too.
And then in the Midnight Star, I'm not sure. I really liked the scene when Raffaele kills Enzo, because I thought that would be, like, a very emotional scene to see.
I don't know. I also, again, and I don't know why I'm, like, all about the battles right now, but when they're coming up, all the ships, and she creates the big wolf and then makes everything go invisible, and then there's, like, the, you know, things keep flickering in and out, and she uses her power against the wrong, like, I think that would be a cool scene. Plus the whole, the sea being like death and the storm raging. I actually think it'd be cool to see the Rainmaker's power, like, on screen.
Yeah, to see him create storms like that.
Yeah. I kind of want more of his backstory, too.
Yeah, me too.
Especially because I thought, like, him and Violetta kind of had a thing at one point, and now she's, like, sick, but he's not really needed on the mission, I guess.
No, I guess not.
But does that mean he's not going to come, or does that mean they just also need to find Taren and...
I mean, someone needs to stay behind, right?
I guess, but for what purpose?
If
this mission fails and the whole world dies, then does anyone need to stay behind?
Well, someone needs to control the kingdom, right?
I guess, yeah.
I'm worried that someone else is going to die because they've been just, like, dropping like flies. I mean, Marie Lou has no qualms about killing off her characters, and I'm just concerned for who's next. And I have a few characters who, if they died, I would be very upset.
Yeah. Especially if any of the characters on the Dagger or Rose Society die at the hand of someone on the opposite end of that alliance.
Yes.
You know, like, if Maggiano dies from something that the Roses do, or if, like, Lucent dies, or, I mean, it's something that the Daggers do, or if Lucent dies from something that the Roses do, or, you know, like, mm-hmm. something crazy like that, then I don't know.
I don't know. If Maggiano dies, I'm going to be really upset. I'm just going to put that out there.
I mean, if he died, then, I mean, even though there's already nothing that can redeem her, then there'd really, really, really be nothing left for her.
I know, that's what I was thinking. I was like, if he dies, there's no saving her.
Yeah.
Ah, I don't know. And I really don't want Maeve or Lucent to die because I really like their whole relationship. And I really want to know what's going to come with that because I really... liked, though, how Lucent refused to be with Maeve if she wasn't going to be, like, made official. Because Maeve was saying that she has to marry someone who can give her an heir, and she has to continue the bloodline. And I kind of liked that Lucent was like, I'm not going to be your mistress. Like, I'm not going to share you.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that's actually really honest and real. Because, I think too many people would have said... like, something's better than nothing, but really, that would just suck.
That would be terrible. And so I really liked that she kind of refused to do that, even though Maeve put that out there as an option. But it makes me wonder, like, well, what's going to happen with them then? Like, will they never be able to be together? Like, will they never...
Well, this whole thing, it's kind of crazy, even when you think about it. Like, there's basically six people off, like, doing all this crazy stuff. Like, the fact that any of them form any relationships is kind of... like, what are the odds it'll last?
That's true. Especially since I feel like whenever you're in the... I mean, not that I've, like, ever been in the midst of battle or, you know, going to heal a rift.
We did go paintballing that one time.
That's true. But I guess, like, in moments when you are so close to death, I feel like those are the moments where you really cling to someone to kind of either feel security or feel love or feel close to someone. Like, I would have to think that putting yourself in danger that way would make you feel a strong connection to someone you loved.
Yeah.
So I get, I don't know, I can see why, even though there's, like, really no time for romance, that they try and seek that out regardless.
No, that makes sense. And obviously, yeah. So, did Michael love Gemma?
I don't know. It seems like he might have, because he really took her death hard. I'm trying to figure out, like, who, yeah. He took her death the hardest, for sure.
Yeah.
Is Michael dead? Sorry, I forget.
Is he dead? I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I think him and the Rainmaker were both, like, told they were basically not needed.
Okay. I think it's Lucent, Maeve, Adelina, Violetta, Taryn, Raffaele, and Maggiano, right, who have to go?
Yep.
Man, so are they going to go to the underworld, do you think? Are they just going to go to the spot where Laetes fell? I'm really interested to see, like...
How do they even know where the spot is?
Raffaele knows everything. He knows.
But it's everything. Like a myth still, so I don't know.
That's a very good question. Maybe he can sense it. You know how he can sense everything? Maybe that's how he knows.
Wait, I was flipping through the book while we were talking about it. So when they were talking about the different alignments and how they needed 12... Raphael basically said, after saying Adelina's and Violetta's, and then he shared his, and he said, including Lucent's alignment, we comprise 9 of the 12. Sergio, your alignments already overlap these, as do Michael's. So I think he's still alive, too.
Oh, okay, good.
But he might not be continued on the journey with them.
Man, I can't wait to see how this pans out.
Yeah. I feel like they need, like, a... Like a school teacher. I don't know. They're just, like, in some ways they seem to me, like, so young still, even though they're not in a lot of ways. But I'm sort of like, I sometimes wish there could just be an adult who'd be like, okay, let's talk this out. Let's use our words.
I feel like they all need therapy. Like, a lot of therapy.
For sure. definitely. Pretty much everyone in this world probably needs therapy at this point. I can't believe we're almost done.
I know. We should, you know what? We should also give the series, like, a rating at the end when we're done. You know? We didn't do that for the Lunar Chronicles.
I mean, we could do it retroactively. What would we rate it on? Just overall?
Yeah.
Like, how much would we like it? Or how would we recommend it? Or how does it compare to...
No, just, like, how much we liked it. Like, five... I don't know. We don't have to do stars. We can do something more interesting. But
five vegetables. How many vegetables?
Vegetables.
I don't know. I'm trying to pick something different.
We should pick something from the book. Like,
oh, that would be better. How many elite powers? How many gemstones?
How many gemstones do we give the young elites? I like that one. What was our rating for the Lunar Chronicles?
I mean, I think I gave it, like, fours and fives on Goodreads each book in the series.
But as a whole?
I'm trying to think back. I, like, am really bad where once I start reading different books, especially really different books, I'm like, I have trouble going backwards and thinking about the old one. Because Lunar Chronicles is just so different from this world.
I know. I think if it's, like, out of a 1 to 10, I think I would give the Lunar Chronicles maybe a 7? Like a 6.5? Just because it was really good, but it was kind of predictable.
Yeah, and I think... I don't know. I think it got better as it went on. Like, I think Cinder, while I really enjoyed it, was especially predictable and, like, didn't add as much, you know, but, like, as each book and everything started connecting and, like, all that, mm-hmm. I started to like it a lot more.
Yes, I would agree. Like, by the end, I was really, really, engaged in all the storylines. Okay, so I'll think of a rating for the how many gemstones I want to give Young Elites. And also, I really want to think of our Young Elite names.
Yeah, okay, we'll think of our Young Elite names, but we also have to think of just, let's also see if we come up with a fan name besides the middle-aged mediocres. Because okay. I'm not putting that on our t-shirt line. Maybe it can go in a hat or something, maybe.
Okay.
Are we even middle-aged? When does middle-age happen?
That's a good question. I mean, 33, according to Dante. Not the Dante in the book, but the Dante from the Divine comedy.
I totally thought you were talking about Dante from the book. I was like, wait, no. Did he really address this?
33.
Okay,
but that was back in that was
when people lived.
So I feel like it's not 33 anymore.
So it has to be further along than that.
I don't think we're there yet. No. I think we're still youngish adults, the youngish elites,
the youngish mediocres.
Doesn't have the same alliteration, but it's more appropriate.
Okay, I'm going to see if I can come up with something better this week, but no guarantees. Okay.
I'm sure you can. It's a low bar. Okay, so we're going to finish The Midnight Star.
AKA the whole series.
Do you think they'll ever make a movie out of this?
I think I actually heard that there might have been something about a movie.
Really?
I don't know. I might be making that up, because that sounds like something I made up.
Can I look it up right now?
Yeah.
I just don't know who they would cast.
Oh, wait, no, I definitely, this is another thing I researched earlier this week, and what did I, because I read an interview with Marie Lu about who she wanted to cast for it.
Oh, will you find that?
Yeah, can I share it next week?
Oh, wait, there's an IMDb page. I wonder if it's just, like, a fan-inspired casting crew, though, because that's, like.
No, I think maybe someone has the rights to it, but I don't think anyone's working on it yet, but I don't know.
Fantasy YA News, the Young Elites film rights sold to Fox. Yeah. In Temple Hill. Oh my gosh. It's really, yeah. Who are they going to cast? I mean, I don't know anyone who has Raffaele's hair. Can we just.
It was Raffaele, she was some young model. I looked him up.
Does he have really long hair? I hope we see some man buns. I really, really want some man buns.
I definitely saved it somewhere. I'll share it next week.
Well, it's good we did this then because we have the no, if it's made into a movie, we're not going to do it rule. So,
good thing we did this now.
Just missed that one. I'm really bad about picking like dream casts, though. Oh, there's a lot of them online, though. And I don't know any of them. I don't know any of these people, but there's so many dream casts online. Oh, now I'm going to stop because now I'm like looking at fan art and that needs it. Okay, do you want to hear my joke for you this week?
I would love to hear your joke for me this week.
I was trying to think of a Memorial Day joke, but that didn't work out. So I just found a joke that's not related to anything. Okay, where does Napoleon keep his armies?
In France.
In his sleeveys.
I feel like my cousins would love that one.
Man, okay. Well, I actually want to go read about Maggiano's flashback, so.
Yeah, I might have to do that before bed tonight.
Okay.
Okay.
Well then, I will talk to you later.
Sounds good. Bye, bookworms.
Go get a library card.
M&K Talk YA is produced and edited by Marissa Snyder and Katie Bradford. Original music composition by Timothy Milkey. Logo design by Marissa Snyder. For updates and extras, visit mnktalkya.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We would like to thank James Tobias, Chad Snyder, Meredith Kelfie, and Michael Howard for all of their support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.